And of course she'd had plenty of practice out in the long earth in the years before that. Living off the land, on the move, was easy. But it was a fantasy to believe that animals that had never met man were naturally tame. An awful lot of good things to eat were too used to running from anything strange. You had to wait. This place was just as she remembered, save for the more recent boot prints she saw as she relaxed and took in her surroundings. Of all the discoveries Joshua and Lobsang had taken back to the datum from their voyage of exploration a decade ago, this was probably the most sensational. Evidence of intelligent dinosaur-like creatures more than 1.5 million steps away from the datum. It had done Lobsang no good to protest that the colony organism that had called itself first person singular was far more interesting and exotic, because nobody understood that. Nor was it any use to point out that the creatures whose remains they'd found here, though reptilian, could not really be dinosaurs in any meaningful sense. There had been a clamour to know more. The universities had received a flood of funding to send out follow-up parties. For a few years, researchers had crawled over this site, though the radioactivity made the work hazardous, and they had sent out drone planes and balloons equipped with infrared sensors and ground-penetrating radar to take a look at the rest of this world. It had surprised nobody to learn that the pyramid, this valley, was only the visible tip of a worldwide culture, ancient, long fallen, buried in the sands of this arid world, which Lobsang and the Mark Twain had not been equipped to explore properly or even detect. In and under the dust, there were traces of cities, roads, canals, not human-like in layout, clearly the product of different minds, but otherwise eerily familiar, and all very ancient. No, these were not dinosaurs, but their ancestors might once have been dinosaurs, just as humans had had ancestors in the dinosaur age, furtive, squirrely, quadruped mammals. Perhaps in this world, the tremendous asteroid impact that had destroyed the dinosaur-dominated ecology of the datum had worked out differently. Here, it might have taken out the big beasts and left behind their smaller, smarter, more agile cousins. The rectangle's creatures were remotely descended from raptors, perhaps. But much later, they had evidently suffered their own extinction event. Maybe there had been war or plague, or another asteroid fell unluckily. In the aftermath, a community of survivors or their descendants, their technology lost, their civilization smashed, had been drawn here by the strange phenomena surrounding a nuclear pile, possibly natural, a chance concentration of uranium ore under that building. It had been a god, a temple, that had slowly killed them. That was one theory, at any rate, a chance concentration of the ore. But from the beginning, there had also been speculation that this pile was not some natural phenomenon, but the ruined and still toxic remnant of a much older and higher technology. The remnant radioactivity came from an abandoned core, or maybe a waste dump. This hypothesis was the subject of much debate, but it fitted Sally's own first impressions when she'd come upon this place. It was kind of satisfying that the answers weren't simple or clear. Like all worlds, this one was no neat, finite theoretical model, but the product of its own long and unique evolutionary history. Sally, moreover, had been through college herself in Madison. She understood enough science to know when a house of theorizing started to totter on foundations of inadequate data and ignored most of the guesswork. She was pleased that Joshua had never revealed the existence of the one tangible souvenir they had brought back from this place, the exquisite ring. It could almost have been crafted by a human jeweler that they had found on the fleshless finger of one post-dinosaur. Pleased that Joshua had kept it all these years. Well, the research money had run out. The long earth was always full of other study targets of various kinds, and the archaeologists had long since sealed up their digs and gone away. And Sally, now in hunting mode, was glad of it. Glad of the solitude. Nobody here but us shadows on the rock. A hot breath on her neck. The hunter hunted, she thought immediately. She hadn't been paying attention. She whirled, reaching for the knife at her belt. A wolf. That was her first impression. Huge, fur bristling, mouth open, tongue hanging, eyes like windows into Arctic waste. It looked as heavy as she was, more, and it had got close enough to taste her, practically, before she'd even noticed. She forced herself not to just step out of here, her first reaction. She wasn't alone on this trip. She had to think of Jansen. She wondered if she had time to shout a warning to Jansen, and whether it would do any good. But the animal didn't attack. It stepped back, one pace, two, raised itself up, and stood on its hind legs, not balancing like a dog doing a circus trick, but standing easily, naturally, as if it were designed to stand like that. Now she saw it had a kind of belt around its waist, from which tools hung, including a very technologically advanced-looking pistol made of some kind of metal that looked like nothing so much as a Buck Rogers sci-fi ray gun and was totally out of place. When the wolf spread its empty paws to her, she saw that the digits were long, flexible, the paws almost like thumbless hands encased in some leathery glove. Surprise heaped on surprise. And then it spoke.
Salilensei.
Its voice was a growl, a rasp, a kind of crudely shaped whisper, but understandable, and the human words were backed up by subtle posture changes, a raise of the head, a twitch of the snout.
Coming here, we knew, Koboldsei. Welcome.
And it lifted its magnificent head and howled. Chapter 40. In the weeks since they'd left behind the Low Chinas, the airships Zheng He and Liu Yang had forged steadily east, their stepping pace gradually increasing, though Roberta learned still far short of their design maximum. Worlds washed below the Twain's bows in great bands, cold or temperate, moist or arid. This eastern stepwise geography, roughly matching the mapping made by American explorers to the west, punctuated by jokers of various kinds, like random flashbulbs. They made periodic stops, and members of the crew went down to the surface, suitably protected, to observe, measure, retrieve samples of the geology, flora, fauna, even exotic atmospheric traces. They followed the Long Earth exploration strategy established by Joshua Valiente a decade earlier, with surface pioneers supervised by controllers on airships above. Roberta, watching from above, made methodical notes. They passed the milestone of 2 million steps from the datum. And now they approached a particular world where, it was planned, Roberta herself was to descend to the surface with Lieutenant Wu Yuesai. The Chinese had reached this world before, and it had been studied, at least to some extent. This first descent was intended as a learning experience for Roberta, she was told, and she accepted that. She had already spent a lot of time in a kind of training chamber with Lieutenant Wu Yuesai, who showed her how to don her jumpsuit and use her individual stepper box and the small monitor sets they would wear on their shoulders, how the captain would speak to them through unobtrusive earpieces, how to use the med packs and emergency rations and silvery blankets in the event they got stranded, how to use the ceramic and bronze handguns they were issued. Roberta took each piece of equipment, each procedure, asked relevant questions, and practiced over and over. Yuesai tried to lighten up the process. She cracked jokes in her imperfect English, and tried to invent games and contests to help the practice go by. Roberta would simply wait until these moments had passed, and then would carry on with her own patient exercises. With time, she felt Yuesai give up on her in a sense, and withdraw. Roberta had observed this many times before. It was not that Roberta Golding did not understand people, rather, she understood them too well. Yuesai's attempts at fun had been transparent exercises in motivation, which Roberta saw through immediately. Besides, with her own sense of inner purpose, she needed no external motivation. Yet that was not enough of a response for Wu Yuesai, and Roberta saw that too. Age 15, Roberta was a person who saw things. That is, she saw them more clearly than those around her. She certainly saw her own limitations, for instance now, as she prepared to face a remote stepwise world for the first time. She could be killed by her own ignorance, or by sheer mischance in the blink of an eye. She saw this and accepted it with a calm that seemed to chill others around her. But what was the purpose of self-delusion? The career towards which she was heading was entirely a matter of stripping away delusion, she sometimes thought. What was the nature of the universe into which she had been born? Why did it exist at all? If it had a purpose, what was it? These seemed to her the only questions worth exploring, and the only valid technique evolved by humans for exploring such questions was the scientific method, a robust and self-correcting search for the truth. Yet it had become obvious to her since about the age of 12 that science, as it had progressed so far, physics, chemistry, biology, all the rest, had only inched towards grappling with the true questions, the fundamentals. Those questions had only been addressed by theologians and philosophers, it seemed to her. Unfortunately, their answers were a mush of doubt, self-delusion and flummery that had probably done more harm than good. And yet that was all there was. For now, she had devoted herself, nominally at least, to theology and philosophy, as well as to explorations of the natural sciences, such as on this expedition. She had even received grants to help support this mission to the Stepwise East from the Vatican, the Mormons, from Muslim orders, and various philosophical foundations. Dealing with such bodies, she had quickly learned when not to share her view that organized religion was a kind of mass delusion. She had to work with what was available. She sometimes imagined she was like the scholars of the European Middle Ages, who had worked their way through the ranks of the church because there was no other organized scholarship around. Or perhaps as if she had been dropped even further into the past, as if she were trying to use stone blades and lumps of ochre to build a radio telescope. Still, she persevered, for there was no choice. Despite her unsatisfactory education, Roberta Golding saw the world clearly, and she saw people clearly, more clearly than they could see themselves. Humanity, she once said, in an answer in a philosophy exam, taken when she was 11 years old, was nothing but the thin residue left when you subtracted the baffled chimp. Responses like that made her a promising scholar, and in Happy Landings, where there were many bright children like her, she had never had any trouble getting picked for the netball team. But here, her lack of response, her habit of speaking in brief lectures, her corrections of simple errors, didn't make the crew warm to her, not even the forgiving USA. The airships settled over a suitable location and, in a methodical fashion, sent up sounding rockets and weather balloons to gain a broader picture of this world. Then USI took Roberta down to the elevator deck. They checked over their equipment one last time and descended to the surface of Earth East 2,201,749. They were standing at the fringe of a forest, close to a sprawling river estuary. From the cover of the trees, Roberta was able to look out over the open plain of the estuary and the wetlands that fringed it to a sharp ocean horizon. She was distracted by huge flying creatures that swept low over the ocean water, a flock of them, each with filmy wings outspread, the largest flyers Roberta had ever seen. Something like pterosaurs, something like bats, something evolved from a different route altogether. Silhouetted in the sparkling light of the sea, they swooped lower, graceful necks dipping, and huge fish, or fish-like creatures, were plucked from the water and gulped down into long beaks. This was a warm, watery world, a world of high sea levels, of shallow oceans that washed far into the hearts of the continents, a world that could support such fantastic visions, and a world, Roberta understood from her studies, with dangers of its own, unknown on drier earths like the datum, not least exotic climatic catastrophes, such as the hypercane already brewing out on the local copy of the Pacific Ocean. Shadows shifted across the forest. USI waved her hand. Roberta made sure the speaker feed from the monitor on her shoulder was off and stood stock still and silent in the cover of the trees. Immense forms moved through the forest, heading for the estuary and the fresh water. Roberta glimpsed compact, muscular bodies on all fours, but with massively powerful hind legs. They were something like kangaroos, she thought, but beefed up, and with their ears flaring into tremendous coloured crests, stiffened with cartilage. There were several of these animals, the adults, taller at the shoulder than Roberta, calves running alongside, and one infant being carried in a pouch at its mother's belly. Silent as a cat, Yuisai slid through the forest, tracking the herd. Roberta followed as best she could. She wasn't as quiet as Yuisai, but the whirring lenses of the shoulder monitor pack were noisier than her footsteps, and she took some pride in that. They came to the edge of the forest, by a braid of fresh water. Across the estuary's damp plain, huge flocks of birds, or bird-like creatures, strutted, squabbled, and fed. With marsh flowers in abundance, it was a mass of colour under a deep blue sky. Roberta thought she saw the characteristic ridged backs of crocodilians sliding through the deeper water. And by the water's edge, the creatures of the forest came to drink. The most obvious, the most spectacular, were those big bulky roos with their colourful sail-like ear crests. The creatures were so huge and heavy, they moved so slowly and patiently, they looked as if they were carved from living rock, and they were so massive that those great hind legs must surely be evolved for kicking, not for jumping like a datum kangaroo. But their ear crests were oddly fragile-looking, almost translucent in the light of the sun, evidently just skin and tissue, stretched over frames of cartilage. The crests were alight with brightly coloured patterns that shifted and dissolved as Roberta watched. Yuisai murmured,
"Are you getting this, Captain Chen, Mr. Montgut?"
"Yes, Lieutenant," replied the captain in their ears. "Try to keep these crests in view. Why so complex a display? I'll have our scholars try passing them through pattern analyzer suites."
Yuisai touched Roberta's shoulder and pointed again, further along the riverbank. More beasts drinking. These were like big flightless, featherless birds, Roberta thought, walking almost daintily, balanced on two big back limbs, but with two small grasping arms in front. Their heads were long, almost snake-like, but with wide, duck-like beaks. When they dipped to the water, sucking noisily, long muscular tails waved behind them. Roberta asked,
"Birds or dinosaurs?"
Yuisai shrugged.
"They're all the same big family. Don't expect anything, Roberta. Don't be surprised by anything."
Roberta understood the principle. The histories of the parallel worlds of the Long Earth had been shaped by similar processes, but differed in the detail. You had to imagine you were travelling across a kind of probability tree, where you found worlds on which some long-past event had turned out differently, thus reshaping life's subsequent history and providing novel raw material for natural selection to mould.
"For example," Yuisai said, "those duckbills look bird-like or dinosaurid, but those big crested beasts are mammals, some kind of marsupial it seems. And there's something you'd never have seen back in the Cretaceous,"
she pointed. "Elves. Stepping humanoids. There was a pack of them, maybe 20, including children and nursing infants. They had found a spot away from the big herbivores, and far enough back from the deep water to be safe from the crocodiles and any other threats. They were scooping up water with their hands, and digging into the mud for roots and worms and mollusks. A few of the younger males were bickering. With irritable pant hoots, they flickered between the worlds, so that to watch them was like trying to follow a badly edited movie."
"There are other sorts here too," Yuisai said softly. "I spotted them in the deeper forest."
The conversation was cut short by a sound of thunder. Yuisai and Roberta shrank back into deeper cover. Some of the duckbills kept drinking, but the big adults looked up suspiciously. The crest roos dipped their great heads and backed into a rough circle. There was a crash, the splintering of wood, a groan as a young tree was felled, and the forest parted like a flimsy stage set, as a tremendous animal burst into the open. Its body must have been 15 yards long, balanced exquisitely on two striding legs, Its arms were small, comparatively, but longer and more muscular than Roberta's own legs, and the right arm had some kind of creeper wrapped around it. Its skin was covered with feathers, brilliantly coloured, like the costume of an Aztec priest. The head was a gaping nightmare of teeth and blood, and when it opened its mouth to roar, Roberta imagined she could smell raw meat. It strode forward, huge, purposeful. It seemed more mechanical than animal, a killer robot, an automaton, and yet it breathed and pawed the earth. The herbivores were already fleeing, following the water's edge, galloping and bellowing. But the elves did not run, not immediately. They scattered into a loose arc, facing the creature, the adults to the fore with stone blades in their hands, the young behind them. But even the young were snarling defiance. It was like another movie scene, Roberta thought. Stone tool-wielding man-apes against the dinosaur. Yuisai was staring, as if unwilling to miss a second of the spectacle.
A dinosaur, all right. Or its 65 million years later descendant. Tyrannosaur-like. Or something else, evolved to fit the same niche.
Of course, China had its own magnificent dinosaur lineages, Captain Chen reminded them sternly. There are other comparisons to be used, Lieutenant.
Yes, sir,
Yuisai said absently.
It could even be a flightless bird. If it is like a tyrannosaur, the odds are this is a female. They had ranges a few miles across. The males were sparser, one every few tens of miles. But what's that on its arm?
The predator's roars and the humanoid's responding snarls and gestures were reaching a climax. Abruptly, the predator charged right into the middle of the elf group. The young with their parents scattered. The adult elves started flickering in and out of existence, faster than the predator could catch them, though she ducked her head, snapped her huge teeth, and swept empty space with her arms and tail. One elf materialized in mid-jump, right beside the predator's head, and took a swipe at her right eye with his blade, before stepping away again, without ever touching the ground. The precision was remarkable, and the predator's eye was saved only by a chance duck of the head. Blooded, enraged, the predator stood at the center of the band of humanoids, unable to land a killing blow on any of them. She roared again, sweeping her huge tail, snapping her teeth. But the humanoids had had enough. They stepped away now, mothers carrying their children, as far as Roberta could see, leaving nobody behind.
You have to hand it to those little guys, Jacques said in their ears. They stood up to their Grendel.
Yuisai shrugged.
Eventually the beast will learn not to tangle with humanoids, especially steppers. And anyhow, they were never her main target. Look.
Now the predator was heading down the beach after the big crest ruse. They had a head start. The ruse, alarmed, tons of flesh and bone on the move, were like a retreating tank division. But one mother hung back to shepherd her calf.
They've got too much of a start, Jacques said.
Are you sure? Captain Chen murmured. Look at what she is doing with her arm.
Roberta could see that the predator was using one agile hand to unwrap the vine from her arm. The vine was maybe 6 feet long and was weighted at either end by something like a coconut. And now, even as she ran, her legs pounding the beach and her spine and tail almost horizontal, the predator whirled the vine and released it. It flew across the intervening space and wrapped itself around the big back legs of the lagging mother Crestru. The vine snapped immediately, but it was enough for the mother to be brought crashing to the ground. Her calf slowed beside her, lowing mournfully, clearly afraid. And it had a right to be, for the predator was on the mother immediately. It ran by and ducked its head to rip a huge chunk out of the Crestru's rear right leg, then almost casually swiped its head against one magnificent flaring ear, crushing the cartilage so the crest folded like a fallen kite. The mother bellowed in pain. But she was able to stand, though blood dripped from the gaping wound. She even nudged her infant to move on as they shambled up the beach after the rest of the herd, which had already cut into the forest. The predator stood and watched them go, by the water's edge, breathing hard. The Crestru's blood stained her mouth. Then she ducked to the water, took a mighty drink, shook her head, and trotted after the mother and calf. It was a pursuit that could have only one outcome.
That predator used a bolus, said Roberta.
Yuisai said,
Yes, it looked as though it could have been a natural object, a vine-like growth with fruit. But there was nothing natural in the way she used it.
Yuisai looked delighted in her quiet way to have made this staggering discovery.
I told you, Roberta. We're far away from home now. Have no preconceptions.
I'll second that, Captain Chen said. And I should tell you that our signal processing experts here inform me that there was data content in the patterns that flared across the crests of those rune-like beasts. They were talking through the visual means of their crests. Sentience. Our onboard scholars must make all this clear when they joint author their paper. A mammal-reptile assemblage of tool-making intelligences beyond Earth East 2 million. How marvelous! What a great discovery for China!
They began to walk back to the pickup point. Chen, evidently enthused, went on,
We Chinese, you know, Roberta, have a utopian legend of our own. There is a story that dates back to the 5th century after your Christ, of how a fisherman found his way through a narrow cave to the land of Peach Blossom, where descendants of soldiers, lost from the age of the Qin Dynasty, lived in a land sheltered by mountains, in peace with each other, in peace with nature. But when the fisherman tried to reach it a second time, he could not find the way. So it is with all utopias whose legends proliferate around the world, even in North America where the natives' dream of the happy hunting ground was displaced by the European settlers' fables of the Big Rock Candy Mountain. Do you think if we travel far enough, we will find such a land, Roberta? Are such legends a relic of some early perception of the Long Earth itself?
There is no sensible content in this discussion, Roberta murmured in reply. And as to the papers you're planning, none of this matters.
Yuisai turned to her.
How's that? Jacques asked.
Roberta gestured at the landscape around her.
The coming hypercane will destroy all this. I've been studying the climatic theory of these worlds, with their high sea levels. They are prone to tremendous hurricanes, extracting heat from the shallow oceans. Storms that can span continents, with 1,000 miles per hour winds. Water vapor is thrown up into the stratosphere, and the ozone layer is wrecked. I've also been studying the records of the weather balloons you launched from the Twains. There's such a storm forming right now. Ask your meteorologists. It's unmistakable. It will take a few more weeks to reach full strength, but when it does, this complicated little community will be right in its path. It's been an interesting experiment, a stepwise mixing of different species, but it will soon be terminated.
There was silence.
Terminated, said Captain Chen at last.
Roberta was used to this kind of reaction to her choice of words, and found it irritating. As if a child were covering its ears to avoid hearing bad news.
All life is terminated, ultimately. I'm only telling the truth. It's trivially obvious.
Again, nobody spoke. Yuisai looked away.
Captain, I think it's time we returned.
Agreed.
Chapter 41 Zheng He and Liu Yang lingered for some days in the vicinity of Earth East 2,201,749. The scientists catalogued their observations and specimens, while the engineers crawled over the airships testing their systems, carrying out routine maintenance. Then they moved on, into realms of the Eastern Long Earth never before explored by Chinese crews or any other, into the unknown. Shortly afterwards, the ships made a longer stop, next to Earth East 2,217,643. Here they found a gap, a break in the chain of stepwise worlds that made up the Long Earth, where the relevant Earth had been removed. Roberta quietly pointed out to Jacques that the first Western gap discovered, by Joshua Valiente, had been at around Earth-West 2 million. No doubt, from the similarity of those numbers, there was some conclusion to be drawn about the nature of the great tree of probabilities that was the Long Earth. Valiente's airship had been wrecked by the step into vacuum that was the gap. The Chinese ships were better prepared. Their crews had their ships hop back and forth across the gap, dropping off hardened automatic probes, which, given the momentum of the spin of the neighbouring Earths, went sailing off into the gap world's empty black sky. Jack stared without much interest at the images returned. Stars that looked much like the stars as seen from any world, planets that seemed to circle in their usual orbits with smug indifference to the absence of an Earth. The crew, though, were fascinated, as they had not been by humanoids and dinosaur descendants. Jack reminded himself that this mission had been mounted by a space agency. No wonder the crew were intrigued by glimpses of the wider universe. And Roberta, too, seemed to be interested. She requested that the probes be made to study the neighbouring planets, Mars and Venus, to look for any difference in their atmospheres, their surfaces. With this initial investigation of the new gap complete, Captain Chen, with a rather boyish and excited grin, came to his passengers and urged them to be at the observation deck the next morning.
That's when the real journey will begin.
When morning came, Jacques and Roberta joined Lieutenant Wu before the big prow windows, Jacques cradling a coffee, Roberta a glass of water. The airships hung in the sky of this latest world, two sleek fish of the sky over a sprawling blanket of forest. There was a river in the middle distance, a glassy stripe, and further away the extensive shallow sea, typical of these warm worlds, blue to the horizon. The stepping began without warning, and worlds flapped by, slowly at first, then ever faster. Soon they were travelling at a step a second, a rate they were all used to by now, and weather systems came and went to the beat of Jacques' pulse, sun, cloud, rain, storms, even some snow. The detail of the forest flickered. Once a tremendous, evidently recent, crater appeared right under the prow of the Zhenghe, before being whipped away like a stage prop. And occasionally a world flared or darkened, and Jacques knew that the ship's systems would be recording yet another joker. Chen joined them, and grasped the polished wooden rail that ran before the window.
You might want to hold on.
Behind them, the trolls began to sing 8 miles high. The stepping rate increased. To Jacques, the passage of the worlds was suddenly visually uncomfortable, as if a strobe light were flashing in his face at increasing frequency. He tried to focus on the position of the morning sun, which remained constant in the multiple skies, but masks of cloud flashed across his face, and the sky flickered white, grey, blue. They all grabbed the rail now, even Roberta. Jacques thought he heard a thrumming of engines, and he sensed the airships driving forward even as they stepped. He could see the silvery hulk of the Liu Yang, Flex, a mighty plastic fish swimming through the flickering light of world after world. Behind them, a crew member threw up.
It will pass, Yue Sai said. We have all been tested for a tendency to epilepsy, and the nausea medication has been carefully applied. The discomfort will pass in a moment.
Faster and faster the stepping came. Faster and faster the weather systems flickered past their view. Jacques forced himself to keep watching, and focused on the rail in his hands. The vibrations of the ship's engines transmitted through the floor under his feet. And then the flickering seemed to fade away, the worlds merging into a kind of continuous blur. The sun, paler than usual, hung in its patient station in an apparently cloudless sky that took on a deep blue colour like early twilight. The landscape below was misty and vague, the shapes of the hills, grey and dim, littered with patches of forest that seemed to grow, shiver, pass away. The river that had been writhing jerkily across the landscape now spread out as if flooding a wide band of ground with a silvery grey, and the ocean coast too became a broad blur, the boundary between land and sea uncertain.
We have passed the flicker fusion threshold, Roberta murmured.
Yes, Chen cried. We are now travelling at our peak rate, an astounding 50 worlds per second. Worlds passing faster than the refresh frames in a digital screen, faster than your eye can follow. At such a rate, we could traverse the great treks of the first pioneers of the Long Earth in little more than half an hour. At such a rate, if we kept it up, we could traverse more than 4 million worlds per day.
Jacques asked, but we're moving laterally too, right? Why's that?
Continental drift, Roberta said immediately.
Chen nodded approvingly.
Correct. On Datum Earth, the continents drift with time. The rate is something like an inch per year. Thanks to those cumulative effects, there is also some drift as you move stepwise. So we move laterally, the great engines working to keep us over the heart of the tectonic plate on which South China rides. Sooner that than get lost altogether.
He winked at Jacques.
Our Chinese airship technology has, incidentally, also set airspeed records.
He checked his watch.
Now, if you will excuse me, I have engineers who need praising, or calming down, or both. Duty calls.
Jacques noticed that the lower digits on the Earth counter mounted on the wall of the deck had become a blur, like the worlds they were tracking, while higher, grander, slower-changing digits marked the tremendous strides they were making off into the unknown. The trolls, meanwhile, sang on. Chapter 42. Vignettes from the continuing mission of Captain Maggie Kaufman as the summer wore on across the Long Earth. The voyage of the USS Benjamin Franklin progressed in a rather disorderly, zigzagging way. The colonists of the Long Earth didn't organize themselves consciously, either geographically or stepwise, and yet a kind of organization was emerging nevertheless, Maggie noticed, with clusters of homesteads growing up in neighboring worlds. Jerry Hemingway of Science was developing a mathematical model of this, of a percolation of mankind into the Long Earth, which resulted in a distribution that he described as on the edge of chaos. Maggie, wearily, thought that summed it up pretty well. Once on the Atlantic coast in a temperate corn belt sky, they encountered a British dirigible called the Sir George Cayley, returning from a mission to Iceland. At such locations as Iceland, incoming steppers rummaged through the parallel worlds looking for beneficent weather. If you got the choice, you would go to a world with the local climatic optima. Change your world, change your weather. In Iceland's case, you sought out analogues of the relatively benign first millennium country first discovered and colonized by the Dark Age Vikings. Dressing up to play the part was apparently optional. Parties from each ship visited the other. British ships always had the best booze, in Maggie's experience, including gin and tonics raised in toast to His Majesty. And the Brit crews, charmingly, always stayed seated for the loyal toast, a tradition going back to Nelson's day, when there had been no room on those crowded wooden ships to stand. However, such pleasing adventures for the Franklin crew were not the norm. More typical was a call to a world some 700,000 steps from the datum, where a hopeful silver miner, who seemed to have got his ideas about excavation techniques solely from the movies, had turned his wannabe mine shaft into a death trap. Getting him out was a technical challenge, but luckily one of the crew, midshipman Jason Santorini, had misspent some of his early years caving. He just loved worming his way into the rubble heaps. When the dispiriting rescue was over, Maggie gave the crew a couple of days' shore leave before moving on. On the second day, as Maggie sat eating lunch with her senior officers on the ground in the shadow of the Franklin, with midshipman Santorini being rewarded for his efforts with lunch at the captain's table, another twain, a small commercial vessel, drifted in from the horizon. It lowered a stairway a little way away in the scrub, and two people alighted stiffly, an elderly woman, a middle-aged man, and a cat that followed them down the ramp. Maggie and her officers stood to greet the couple. Joe Mackenzie eyed the cat suspiciously. The man said,
Captain Maggie Kaufman, I'm pleased to meet you in the flesh, having heard so much about you. It took us some time to arrange a rendezvous, as you can imagine.
And you are?
My name is George Abrahams. This is my wife, Agnes. My title is Doctor, though that need not concern us.
His accent sounded vaguely Bostonian, the name naggingly familiar to Maggie. He was tall, slim, a little stooped, and wore a heavy black overcoat and a Homburg over silver hair. His face was oddly neutral, expressionless, unmemorable, Maggie thought. The cat, slim, white, looked around, sniffed, and set off in the general direction of the Franklin. Mac nudged Santorini.
Keep an eye on that damn flea bucket.
Yes, sir. Maggie invited them to sit, courteously enough, and Mac, evidently acting out of a kind of reflexive politeness, even poured them coffee. Then Maggie said more sternly,
Tell me how you found us, Dr. Abrahams. This is, after all, a military vessel. And what do you want of me?
How he had been following her seemed innocent enough. Through alternate accounts posted by civilians of the Franklin's various interventions, all of this was public. As to the what, that concerned the troll call. Maggie snapped her fingers.
Of course. Yours is the name on the instruction sheet.
I am its designer, he said, not particularly modestly.
And his wife rolled her eyes.
From all accounts, you got the measure of it very quickly. Amazingly so, if you don't mind my saying it. Well, I come bearing gifts. I have 15 more translators for you and your crew. Of course, they are still only prototypes, though refined versions. As we develop them further, both parties are learning to use the gadgets, trolls and humans, I mean. As I'm sure you've found out, trolls are patient, and they learn just as fast as humans. Oh my goodness, how they learn. And of course they remember. They remember everything.
Well, thank you, Maggie said nonplussed. We'll happily take possession of the troll calls, after security checks. You know Sally Lindsay, I take it. And, I have to ask, are you associated with the Black Corporation?
Oh, my dear lady, two interrogations in one sentence? Of course I know Sally, a remarkable judge of people, and as harsh as a hanging judge when she's in the mood. As for the Black Corporation, he sighed. Yes, of course they are involved. Captain, I am independent. I have my own workshop. Yes, I am in partnership with the Black Corporation, but they don't own me. They did fund my work, and arranged delivery of the prototype to you.
Once again, Douglas Black is giving away technological treasures for free.
My impression is that Douglas Black believes that to release such a technology should, in the long term, have a beneficial effect on humanity's career in the Long Earth. And in the short term, it may heal our fractured relationship with the Trolls. I, of course, have worked closely with the Trolls in the course of my studies. What wonderful beasts they are, don't you think? And so soulful. Anybody who has ever owned pets knows that animals have something which equates to a soul.
The wife nudged him.
You're preaching, George, and what's more, to the converted. We've done what we came to do. Now it's time to wave goodbye and let these good people get about their duties.
That seemed to be that. Slightly bewildered, Maggie and her officers arranged to collect the troll calls and rose to wish the couple goodbye. The wife, who seemed oddly elderly compared with the husband, fussed as they retreated to their ship.
Do get on, dear. Remember your prostate.
Don't ham it up too much, Agnes.
It was only after they had gone that Mac looked around and said,
What happened to that damn cat?
Their next assignment was in a stepwise Nebraska, on the way back to the Corn Belt, where the hunter-gatherer type wandering inhabitants of nearby parallel Americas periodically got together for what they described as a hootenanny, a mixture of marriage market, farmer's auction, rock concert, and Hell's Angels gathering, These events were magnets for trouble. But for the Franklin, the assignment was routine, the ship's very presence a deterrent to disorder. Maggie took the opportunity to have her chief engineer, Harry Ryan, run a comprehensive overhaul of the ship's systems. It had been a while since the last maintenance break. Among other small issues, he quickly reported problems with the Franklin's two remaining winged aircraft, microlights, capable of air launches for fast response. They had already cannibalized a third craft for spares. As she was scanning Harry's report in her sea cabin, Maggie became aware of a steady gaze. It was a cat. The cat. George Abraham's cat, standing patiently on the carpet, gazing at her. Slim, white, healthy-looking, she was a breed indeterminate to Maggie, who was no cat person. Her eyes were eerie green sparks, sparks like LED displays Maggie saw looking closer. And the cat spoke, a liquid string of syllables in a female human voice, quite incomprehensible.
What? What? I apologize, the cat said. George and Agnes Abrahams used me to practice their Swahili. It became my default setting. I am aware that you are running a systems check.
Maggie, floundering, found a memory floating to the surface of her mind.
Joshua Valiente. He had a talking cat, didn't he? So the story goes.
Then she realized that not only was the cat talking, she was engaging the cat in conversation.
I am fully equipped to support your current activity. The systems analysis, I mean. Turbine number 2 is developing metal fatigue. Also, the flush in the aft crew bathroom is malfunctioning. Rodent infestation is negligible, but not zero, by the way.
Maggie stared at the cat. Then she came around her desk, grabbed the cat, and set her on the desktop. The beast was heavier than she had thought, but she felt comfortably warm. She thought over what the cat had said. Then she slapped a comms panel.
Hey, Harry.
Here, Captain, the engineer replied promptly.
How's the rear crew head?
What?
Let me check my roster. A 40 flush, as it happens. Why do you ask, Captain?
How about turbine number 2?
No faults reported.
Would you check it over again? Call me back.
She stared at the cat.
So, what the hell are you? An artificial life form. Well, evidently, including top-of-the-line artificial intelligence. The nice thing about artificial intelligence is that at least it's better than artificial stupidity, don't you think? Ha ha.
Her voice was fully human, but diminished, as if issuing from a small loudspeaker. Maggie stayed stony-faced.
That couple, Dr. and Mrs. Abrahams, left you behind. I am another gift, Captain. Forgive the subterfuge. It was thought that you would refuse me reflexively. Yet I am capable of supporting your mission in a variety of ways, a mission to which I am fully committed, by the way. You have a name? Shimi, which is Tibetan for cat. I am an upgrade of previous models.
Maggie's comms unit blipped. Harry Ryan.
Don't know how you guessed it, Captain, but there is a flaw in number 2 turbine. Metal fatigue in the bearings. We'll need to strip it down within 7 weeks max. Best to do that in dry dock. It's a very fine imbalance. It wouldn't have shown up for a few more days running, but there is a rising chance of failure. Captain, I'm embarrassed we didn't spot it.
Forget it, Harry. Ask Nathan to put together an itinerary to take us home.
Yes, Captain.
Jimmy said modestly.
The turbine didn't sound true. Easy to spot. It was, however, only one cat's opinion.
But you're not just a cat, are you?
No, Captain. I was built to the finest standard specifications of the Black Corporation's robotics, prosthetics, and artificial intelligence divisions. whereas your turbine was built for the government on a low-bid contract. Thank you very much, and I hope I have passed the audition. Incidentally, would you be offended if I brought you an occasional mouse? It is rather traditional. No. Yes, Captain. And stay out of Joe Mackenzie's way. Yes, Captain. Does that mean I can stay aboard? Just get out of here. Yes, Captain.
Chapter 43. Lobsang pulled strings at the Black Corporation and secured Joshua and Bill the use of an airship for the purposes of their quest in search of Sally Lindsay and the trolls. It was a relatively small, nimble craft with a translucent solar capture envelope a couple of hundred feet long and a gondola the size of a truck trailer with walls of ceramic panels and big viewing windows, primarily used as a scout to accompany the great stepwise convoys on the Valhalla run. The ship had no name, only a corporate registration number. Bill promptly named it the Shillelagh. Bill, for reasons he'd yet to share with Joshua, said he wanted to fly not out of the usual Mississippi ports, but from the Seattle area in the Pacific Northwest. The quickest way to transport the airship from its base at a low-Earth Hannibal to Seattle was to break it down, ship it by rail across the datum, and then reassemble it on an apron at SeaTac Airport. That took a week. The travelers used the time to prepare, to gather supplies and kit for the journey. Regarding the trolls, Lobsang provided them with what he called a troll translation kit, downloaded into a neat jet black slab, small enough to fit into a backpack. As for Sally, Joshua did some snooping as Bill had requested, visited the hotels she'd stayed at, even Jansen's home, looking fruitlessly for leads as to where she'd gone. And he had to face the family he was leaving behind, as he disappeared on yet another jaunt into the remote earths, once again leaving at Lobsang's behest, once again pulled sideways by Sally, Helen's enigmatic rival. Little Dan was jealous, pure and simple. He wanted to go exploring too. Helen, who was struggling to get permission to visit her Madison bomber brother in prison, was ominously silent. It wasn't a happy family that Joshua left behind, and not for the first time, and it tore his heart in two. But off he went anyhow. And on an impulse, he took the sapphire ring, his one souvenir of his first long Earth quest a decade ago, took it from where it had been hanging on Jansen's wall, and hung it up in the gondola lounge. He wondered if Sally would expect him to do that. Thus, on a bright June morning at Dayton SeaTac, Joshua found himself sitting in this compact gondola, laid out just like a travel trailer, with a tiny galley area and lounge, fold-away bunks and tables. In fact, he learned it had been designed by Airstream, while Bill took his place in the small wheelhouse of the gondola's prow. The Shillelagh lifted easily. Soon Joshua had a fine view of the airport and the crowded development around it and of Puget Sound, all of which was whipped away as they began to step, to be replaced by the increasingly sparse facilities of SeaTac West 1 and 2 and 3, with their ribbons of road and rail tracks and small settlements cut into the enduring forest, each world glimpsed in the space of a heartbeat, until soon, after only a very few worlds, there was barely a sign of mankind at all, only the forest and the sound and the cascades piled up in the distance. The ship rose steadily as it stepped, and Bill directed it laterally towards the mountains, which persisted more or less unchanged as they passed through the worlds. The sky flickered, though. The weather was never unchanging from earth to earth, and on this June day they passed from sun to cloud to showers. In the first few worlds, there was nothing much to see but treetops. Joshua knew there were bears down there in those forests, and beavers and wolves, and people too, although further out than the low earths, there was only a long but thinning tail of colonization. More rats than people, probably, now that the twains with their roomy holds and cargoes of foodstuffs flew so thick. What else was down there was guesswork.
There was a program to map the low Earths from orbit with small fleets of pole-to-pole satellites that would fly over a turning world, inspecting its continents, oceans, and ice caps with cameras, ground-penetrating radar, infrared, and other sensors, before stepping on to the next world and the next. Even such coarse imagery, which would show few details smaller than a reasonably sized car, was only available for 100 or so of the lowest worlds. Further out than that, save for particular worlds which had been subject to closer study, nobody knew, really. They were climbing the flank of Mount Rainier itself by the time they hit the first Ice Age world. For a few seconds they rode high over the crumpled white sheets that coated the ground, and then back to the endless forest green. Joshua sat back, watching the scenery blankly. Already he missed his family. He wondered how he was going to pass the time. Bill?
Yes?
Just checking. How is everything?
Cracker.
Good.
I just need to concentrate on the piloting. Not my usual occupation, but the Black Corporation lads gave me a decent run-through. It's simple enough, but not like driving a car, I tell you that. Or even riding a horse. After all, the ship has to be sapient, to a degree. And it's smarter than a damn horse, in fact. It's like you have this constant dialogue with the thing. You know, I once rode an elephant on this farm in the African bush, a rescue sanctuary. An African elephant isn't tamed like the Indian sort. He's a big, strong, smart animal that knows where he wants to go, and if you're lucky, that might happen to be the same way you want to go. Otherwise, you just have to kind of hang on. This is the same. All a bit mad, isn't it? But we'll get there, wherever there is.
Fair enough. And that was that. It was just like the journey of the Mark Twain all those years ago, but at least this time Joshua got on better with his crewmate. By sunset, they had sailed out of the ice belt, as it was called, the sheaf of sporadically glaciated worlds around the datum, and were passing over the more arid worlds of the mine belt. The view got even more dull. Joshua made a meal, of field rations warmed on a single gas ring, no gourmet kitchen on this ship, and took a portion to Bill, who was camping out in the wheelhouse. Then he turned in, looking out through the gondola's windows as the dying rays of midsummer sunsets glowed on the gas bag. The dawn brought more of the same. By mid-morning of the second day, they had crossed into the Corn Belt, 100,000 steps from Datum Earth, a thick band of warmer worlds, lush with forests and prairie, and now studded with human farming communities, including Reboot at Earth West 101,754, founded by Helen and her family of Trekkers, at the place where she and Joshua had married. Then, in the late afternoon, Joshua sensed the airship slowing. The strobing of the skies slowed, and the more or less identical landscapes below flickered gently, coming to a standstill. And an angry buzzing filled the air. Suddenly the gondola was dark, the light excluded by a swarm of dark, heavy insectile bodies that slammed continually against the clear windows, chitinous wings clattering. Joshua glanced at the gondola's compact earthometer. This was West 110,719. He had to yell over the noise.
Hey, Bill!
Here!
I recognize this place.
You should. Classic Joker. In fact, you discovered it during the journey with Lobsang.
Yeah, and we passed straight on through. What are we doing here, Bill? Those bugs are going to choke us if they get in the air vents.
Patience, Grasshopper.
The airship lifted now. Joshua could feel it, though the world remained hidden by the swarming, angry bodies of the flying insects. They were like huge locusts, perhaps, an impression he remembered from that first visit. Abruptly, the shillelagh rose into sunlight. Joshua saw he was still hovering over the flanks of Rainier, or this world's copy of it. Evidently this world was warmer than the average, for forest rose up almost all the way to an eroded summit. It was oak woodland, mature trees rearing out of a luxuriant tumble of fallen trunks and thickets. He spotted a stream down there, bubbling down the steep slope of the mountain. As he watched, something blundered through the undergrowth and crashed away east, and a few roosting creatures took fright and rose up. They weren't birds, they were like huge fat dragonflies, and fluttered noisily away to safety. When Joshua looked away from the mountain summit, he saw a landscape cloaked by swarming insects, a pulsing, gleaming carpet of them that seemed to extend all the way to the ocean shore visible in the distance. The land crawled with them, like black rivers coursing between sparse patches of green, and clouds of flyers rose up everywhere. But nothing flew as high as this summit, and not as high as some of the other mountains of the Cascades, whose flanks rose out of the swarms like green-clad islands in an insectile sea.